on this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
It's up to you whether or not you want to waste your life or squander your education versus applying yourself and doing what it is that's going to make you a better person in the moment. But my one request is that
I got my Corvette and, you know, I get to bang hot chicks all the time. And that sucks that you have to, you know, do that kind of stuff. It's crazy that we don't prize that.
And it's very easy for me to let her wear the pants in the family, to let her be the leader. And so I can be a little boy, you know, off, you know, pulling on a Speedo to go swim in Hawaii in a triathlon.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Hey, so today is a pretty fun podcast episode. My wife and I got a chance to travel down to San Jose, and we sat down with the wonderful, wonderful fellows at Mind Pump, Sal, Adam, and Justin. And if you haven't heard any of my previous podcasts with the guys at Mind Pump, you are missing out. And I will link to them in the show notes to this episode. They've interviewed me multiple times. I've interviewed them multiple times. And they're just some really cool cats. This time, though, my wife came along for the fun. And we talked fatherhood, parenting, homeschooling, religion, muscle maintenance, her sourdough bread recipe, a whole lot more. And so what I'm going to do is I've got pretty robust show notes for you that you can find at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/pump parenting. That's BenGreenfieldFitness.com/pump parenting, as in Mind Pump parenting. Although we talk about a lot more than just parenting in this particular episode. The folks at Mind Pump also have put together some amazing fitness programs, including some that really help you to stay fit at home, perhaps during a pandemic. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And so that also I will all put over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/pump parenting. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a Rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com.
I asked you this off air, Ben. I want to ask you again because the last time I saw you, you were like a good 15 pounds of lean body mass smaller.
Yeah. But Sal sizes everybody.
At least you look jacked right now.
I think
now.
It's the shirt.
No, it's not, it's dude. The shirt. It's not. A you know, I'm shirt. Come on, get out of here. You put on some serious muscle recently. What are you doing differently? What's going on?
Stuck at home for MAPS anabolic. Days. I did the Russian kettlebell cert. Mm-hmm. So I spent the first half of COVID training for that. So I had a ton of kettlebells.
How'd you like that?
A ton of overhead farmers walks and snatches, Turkish get ups. And I would just keep ordering heavier and heavier kettlebells. I love it. And I want to do RKC too, but they keep moving it with the pandemic farther in the future. So every time I get excited about the snatch test again, it just gets thrown a little bit farther down the road. Then I did, a lot of BFR training, like 3 times a week. Two failure, full body BFR training. My kids actually got a lot of really good meat sponsors for their podcast, like Bel Campo and Butcher Box. And then this guy named Ty Lopez, who partnered up with Joel Salatin. He's got a farm now. So they're sending my podcast meat for that. And so we have a ton of meat. We have a ton of organ meats. I started doing about 12 of those ancestral supplements, organ capsules, like heart, liver, kidney, what else? They got lung, they got brain, so a ton of liver, and liver, organ meats, kettlebells, BFR training, and then I'm still doing a lot of BPC and TB500.
Dianabol.
In between. Yeah, Dianabol.
C3PO.
Does it feel like your body was craving to grow because it seemed like you just put it on? Do you feel like you were holding it back, and then and do you feel better with more muscle mass?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I was telling Adam, especially going into the winter when you don't want to be cold and frail and weak. I don't want to be the first one that the wolves or the bears get. No, but in all seriousness, I like to maintain a little bit of extra muscle, but all the guys in my family are so lean. It's hard. Like you do have to eat a lot.
Really?
And for me, probably with my one weak link, if I have one weak link, it's gut. I have to be careful when I'm eating a lot to really select my foods. You know, like we were talking about, I'm doing no FODMAPs, no legumes, no prebiotic fibers, very few probiotics. So I'm pretty much doing like meat, tubers, fish, bone broth, organ meats, some berries, still doing a little bit of like a good clean protein powder with some colostrum and things like that in the mornings. But yeah, just a lot of nutrient dense, super clean food, but it is hard to eat a lot.
I imagine you're similar. I mean, we have a similar bone structure, similar height. I would think that you have to be north of 4,500 calories to maintain. Or
yeah, I think 4,500 for me right now would be tops. I think I'm going like 3,500 to 4,500.
Well, 35 is not bad. I found once I start getting over 40.
This little lady next to me right here, she just keeps shoving food in my face, and I eat it like a good boy.
I can't keep it coming.
Well, you're both obviously a picture of health. I think you guys represent what you talk about pretty darn well. So that's pretty cool. Do you notice any changes in performance because with more muscle mass, because you are most of the time I've known you like to really do things like obstacle course racing, hanging off things, and is it make it more challenging because you're heavier, or does the strength offset that?
Well, we were talking with the doctor this morning because we're going over to a clinic after this to get just some work done, and the doctor asked me what hurts, and I pause him. Said, nothing. Like I feel great. because, and you hit on something there, I'm not racing anymore. And that's probably a big part of that. That's a big part of the weight gain too, is I went from running, you know, sometimes 20, 30 miles a week. I'm running maybe.
Give your body a break.
So my running right now is when I go check the mail, I sometimes run up from the mailbox. So I'm running like a mile a week right now. And then we play a little bit of family tennis. We do family tennis usually a couple of nights a week. And so a lot less chronic cardio, a lot less running. I was even training for a triathlon last year. So a lot less swimming, a lot less cycling, and just basically a lot of kettlebell and a lot of BFR.
Yeah. The thing about resistance training that I like so much, and one of the reasons why I think it's the perfect exercise prescription for the modern, for modern life, is that it's pro tissue, whereas lots of cardiovascular activity tends to be, you know, anti tissue as your body tries to become more efficient and become better at this kind of long duration, high oxidative stress type of activity. Resistance training done properly, just for longevity, not saying you shouldn't do any cardiovascular activity, but resistance training, just it's better for longevity. You just feel better. It's a totally different feeling.
I think honestly, the as simple and non-complex as it sounds, I think lifting heavy weights, walking a shit ton, and then playing some sport that forces you to sprint every once in a while is just like that's the perfect match.
I think that's just
about everything from a physiological standpoint.
I would 100% agree. Back to the gut health thing, I've read studies that show that athletes and hard training individuals suffer from gut health issues at a much higher rate than the average person, which kind of sounds contradictory, right? If you're a hard training person, you work out a lot, you're probably very health conscious.
Really? You think it is?
This is what the study showed.
I can tell you what I think it is. And it's paradoxical because they have found, I believe it's the firmicutes to bacteroid ratio in elite athletes tends to be more favorably oriented towards metabolic efficiency, towards harnessing energy from carbohydrates more efficiently. And there was even an Outside magazine article, I think it was last year, about whether or not people would start getting fecal microbiota transplants from elite athletes, like get the same gut biota as an athlete. But the biome aside, we know, and we've known for a long time in exercise physiology, that gut permeability increases when blood flow is directed away from the gut, all the more so during high intensity interval training, all the more so during high intensity interval training or exercise in general in the heat, right? And this is why even like back when I was racing Ironman years ago, I would always use colostrum. I would load with colostrum for a couple weeks going into a race just because of the research that also shows that limits that amount of gut permeability onset.
To seal those junctions.
Furthermore, I would not go near ibuprofen or Advil or any NSAID during a race or after, because when you combine that increased gut permeability with something that's mildly toxic to the liver and the kidneys, it's a recipe. You essentially simulate rhabdo with that type.
And then you combine that with probably
toxic shock.
Different eating behaviors too, right? When you're an athlete, you tend to like get down on meals on a whole nother level than somebody who's just sedentary lifestyle.
Sometimes you're eating when you still have blood flow directed to your extremities.
Always. Yeah. I mean, you're encouraged to eat right after a workout. And if you've got some systemic inflammation going on, which is going to happen, especially after an intense workout. And then on top of it, you're consuming a quote unquote easily digestible food like a shake, which is, you know, it's probably even more likely to pass through your gut than solid foods. So that combination over time, I feel like, is the perfect storm. I agree with your theory on that. But I do notice that because I'm sensitive to gut stuff, my gut issues, something I'm always kind of dealing with. When my training is through the roof, is when I need to be the most careful. So yeah, it makes perfect sense.
I think nearly every athlete should be on something that's going to alter the opening of the zonulin protein that makes the gut more permeable. So, you know, whether that is colostrum or lignite or anything like that is going to help to keep that tight junction closed. I think that just about any athlete should be on a really good enzyme complex, especially for any fat or protein rich meals. And finally, they should have a giant slice of your sourdough bread, babe, every night with some grass-fed butter, and salt, and honey on it.
And that
would solve all the world's woes.
Now, I'm assuming that's real sourdough.
So it is.
The gluten is all, I guess, out, right? What happens through the process?
It's somewhat out.
It basically pre-digests the gluten. So gluten isn't gone. It's just gone through the starter, and it eats the gluten and digests it. So when you eat it, you actually don't have to do all – your stomach has to do all the hard work of breaking gluten down. It's already partially broken down.
Now, how do you – how long a process –
But if you have celiac disease, you're still going to paint the back of the toilet seat if you have
– Yeah, I wouldn't.
Thank you for the visual.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. No, so how long does it take to make real sourdough at home?
At least 24 hours.
Okay. So it's a process.
Yeah, but it's mostly just waiting.
Okay.
It's
okay.
not that hard. I think the hardest thing is keeping it alive.
Mm. Yeah.
Now,
what we talked about before you came on the show, when you had told us you'd be in the area, you had suggested it would be a good idea to do a podcast on parenthood and raising children. And I think you two.
I thought I said guns, vaccines, and
abortion.
Abortion and the questionable gender of track and field athletes.
Yes.
Those are the main things we want to tackle.
Let's
jump into each of those.
Let's lose everybody.
Political affiliations.
No, we're talking about parenthood. And I think you both are two of the most interesting people on this particular topic. We've been to your house. Justin spent the night there, a while ago.
No, I didn't, but I definitely was there.
But you were there.
Had your delicious meals.
It was great. You are both two of the most involved parents, that I've ever met with your children. You're involved in, almost every aspect of what's going on.
You can call us helicopter parents.
No. I was just going
to
say.
We just don't want them to die, Sal.
Helicopter involved are very different.
You guys don't feel that way. Do you really, though? You don't feel like you're helicopter parents, do you?
Oh, okay. My gosh, no.
I was going to say, I don't feel like you.
If anything, anti-helicopter.
Yeah, parents. I don't think you
No, what I mean by involved is you're literally present and involved. It's, you know, your kids aren't just, you're present. You're involved with the whole process. Definitely not helicopter. I see your kids having a lot of freedom to fail and to succeed kind of, on their own. So I think you guys are great people to talk to. Plus you guys homeschool, which I think is an interesting topic. I know right now homeschooling is exploding.
Oh yeah.
It's the fastest growth.
It sounds like the best way to do it right now.
Yeah. Well, and Ben grew up when it wasn't cool.
I grew up when homeschooling wasn't
when it
cool.
Was like,
you're ahead of your time.
I wish I could hit the rewind button because that would be so cool right now. And I was homeschooled in the traditional manner. You buy curriculum. You know, back when I was homeschooled, it was the Saxon math curriculum or the Usborne books or any number of different, Abeka was another very popular curriculum. And you'd order typically in many cases, the same books from the same organization. So you had your math, your reading, your writing, your logic, your grammar, your social studies, whatever. And you order that all from Usborne or from Abeka or from Saxon or from any of these folks who would then send all the books to your house. Kind of like when you start a semester in college and you go to the bookstore, you get all your books. And then you go through lesson plans with mom and sit around the kitchen table and, everybody, meet at the kitchen table at 8 and we go through all the books. And occasionally there's some kind of a group activity with other homeschoolers in the afternoon. Very traditional, dyed-in-the-wool homeschooling scenario, and that is not what we do with our kids.
Really?
At all.
I want to start there, actually. I feel like we've gotten to know each other really well in the last, what has it been, almost four years? It's been 4 years?
It's been 4 years.
Yeah. And, I consider you a good friend of ours. And I'd say that the thing that I probably know the least about is really your childhood and, like, your upbringing. I feel like I've gotten pieces of it through the years, but I'd really like to dive into that, your relationship with your parents, what it was like when you were a kid. And that I think will.
Well, that has such a strong influence on how you parent. I think that's a great place to start.
It has an influence not only in the way you parent, but also in the way you partner. Jess and I have even been digging into this a little bit in terms of our relationship and the attachment theory. In terms of whether you were given a lot of attention when you were young, in terms of whether you were left to fend for yourself, in terms of how
explain
much
the
you
theory.
Had to. So I'm not very good at explaining attachment theory, and I'm going to totally bastardize it. But essentially, some people are born and grow up with anxious attachment where they really look to other people for verification, for compliments, for words of affirmation, and for things that make them feel as though they're okay. They don't have to be anxious about
approval.
Anything. Mom and dad are giving them verbal approval and saying good job, and they grow up really digging that kind of approval and almost needing it and still needing it from a partner when they're married or they're with a partner. And then there's another one that's more of like, it's almost the opposite of attachment. It's, do you remember what it's called, babe? It's, or the opposite of anxiety. Avoidance. Yeah. So avoidance would be, I want to be left alone. I was, you know, I was maybe left to be very independent, and I love my independence, and I want my independence, and I don't want a partner who's in my face all the time, and I'm very self-sufficient and independent, and that person would not necessarily be the person who needs as many words of affirmation. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole idea of the five love languages. You know, words of affirmation or quality time or gifts or certain things that really mean a lot to your partner when you express those to your partner. And, you know, for example, I kind of skew a little bit towards anxiety attachment, and Jessa kind of skews a little bit towards avoidance attachment. Mm. And so in our relationship, one thing that I found myself doing for years was I'd worry if she was okay. Right. Like when I'm making coffee in the kitchen, I look up and she's in the kitchen and I can't quite tell if she's smiling or if she looks like she got up and she's in a good mood. I'll be like, you okay, babe? And she'll be like, yeah, I'm okay. You sure? I can't. You sure you're okay?
And by the end of the morning, I'd want to cut you.
And by the end of the morning, Jess is like, I'm okay. Damn it. And for me, what we've realized is that because my love language is, words of affirmation, if Jessa wakes up and she says something like, gosh, I'm still thinking about how great that steak was that you cooked last night.
Mm.
Or, you know, that coffee smells amazing. You make such good coffee, you know, or something like that. Like I feel zero need to ask her if she's okay. Mm. Like it's like, that's all me projecting me on her. So it's really interesting. And so kind of a rabbit hole from what you were saying about how the way that you are raised affects the way that you parent. Mm-hmm. You know, it also affects the way that you interact with your spouse to a certain extent.
Now, how were you how do you think the way you were raised made you skew towards that type of attachment?
You know, I was kind of noodling on this because I'm, you know, my mom, I really depended on her for approval. I really looked to her for you're doing a good job. You know, you're good, you're great, and gosh darn it, people like you. And I think that I look to her a lot for compliments. And so I still grew up looking to women in my life, such as my wife, for those same type of compliments. Yet I married someone who's very like tomboyish, more of the avoidance there, who's wouldn't necessarily think of, unless we had a conversation about it, oh, like compliment this person. Cause for her, and we were talking about this, it almost feels like
unauthentic.
Like inauthentic.
Like, and that sounds terrible, but I'm right. I just don't, like, compliments do not come to my mind at all. Like, I mean, it's not that I'm like, I don't think it. It's just, I don't, voicing it just feels weird to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And plus the fact that Jess and I we met in second grade Sunday school, but we really got to know each other well in college, and we're very competitive. We did triathlon, she raced track and field. So we've sand volleyball, everything. We've always been a very competitive couple. And so part of it too is like when she compliments me, it's almost like it rubs against our innate tendency to compete with one another and to try and one up each other.
Unless she like beats you, right? And she's like, you did a good job.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like
that was your best effort.
I'm wired up to be an achiever.
Here's your red ribbon.
Like, you know, if I take a personality profile, I'm achiever, perfectionist, and Jessa is more people pleaser type B. And, you know, one of the ways I'll compete with her is if I see her out in the porch drinking a glass of wine, just like, you know, lounging at whatever, 6 p.m. and I come up and it's like an hour before dinner or whatever, and I see her out there, you know, I will literally say, well, I've got about an hour of work still and about 30 emails I still got to finish. So I'll be up from the office in about an hour. So I'll see you then. I'm going to go get some work done.
Yeah.
And like, I'll literally like find myself doing things like that just because we're still competitive with each other. So
you guys are actually the reverse of Katrina and I, very, very similar. So I could totally relate to the feeling unauthentic to just say compliments to say them. Mm-hmm. So I actually, and I love the five love languages. I recommend that to anybody in a relationship. Mm-hmm. I think it brought so much insight to Katrina and I and how we navigate. We've been together for 10 years. So of course we've learned a ton about each other. And I can never compliment enough, for her. And so I'm always trying to practice things that feel authentic and real that it provides that for her. Something that I've done that's helped that is I just make a point. I try and do this at least once a month where I get her flowers and like write a card.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And if I sit down.
Is that her language is receiving a gift?
Actually, gifts aren't affirmation. It's the card that really matters. The flowers is the message.
Bonus.
Yeah. The flowers is a bonus. She likes them in the house and they're pretty. The card is what means everything to her. She would rather, and this was hard for me when we first started dating, I was the shower with gifts because that's my thing. So, I mean, bought her all these nice clothes all the time.
Because the way that you thought was, well, of course she's going to love to get gifts. I love to get gifts. Exactly. She's got to love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Yeah. That's not the language your partner speaks.
No. And I actually think this is like one of the biggest things where people miss in their relationship because, and no one is really guilty because you feel like you're trying. I remember when we had this first, you know, paradigm shattering moment in our relationship because she had felt like, I wasn't giving her that love. And I remember like going, literally last week, I just dropped like $500 on new Lulu outfits.
I can pull the receipts.
Right. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I stopped in my day. I thought about her. I went and bought her all this stuff and I brought it home for no reason, no holiday. Like, how is that not showing love? But it took me a while to make that connection that I could do that all day long and she's still not feel loved because I'm constantly speaking my language and not hers.
Mm-hmm. And now, Ben,
I think – go ahead. One thing that comes to mind – I realize I haven't even answered your question about my childhood yet, Sal. But one thing that comes to mind regarding that whole idea of gifts as being a language of love is I also think that that can lead to a certain form of lazy parenting, meaning that – you know, in many cases, we feel as though we're doing a good job as parents if we, you know, take our kids to some expensive steakhouse and then, you know, the next day a trip to the zoo, an arcade and a movie. And we just try and make every moment epic or every moment extremely, extremely valuable with cash, with money. When in fact, I think that time and traditions trump that big time. Oh, big. Like I can tell you, like if you have breakfast for dinner on Tuesday night where dad makes eggs and waffles every Tuesday night for, you know, 8 years of their childhood, they're going to remember that more than any, you know, random trip to Vegas where, you know, you blew $1,000 on the whole family at dinner at a Japanese restaurant. Mm-hmm. Or if they've got every single Christmas, you know, they're doing the 24-day Advent calendar and getting a little chocolate and, you know, and doing a little bit of reading each morning, you know, for this 24 days building and building and building to Christmas every single year. When they grow up and you ask them about Christmas, they're probably going to talk about that tradition and that memorable habit that's a part of, you know, the family than they will that 1 year they got the Huffy, you know, the shiny Huffy bike that they'd always wanted. You know,
I found that with my kids, just building things with them was everything, like, you know, taking them to, like, I knew my son was into tetherball. And so we just, like, his gift for Christmas was all of us were going to put this together and, like, make it from scratch and everything. And then, you know, their bike ramp and all this, just that vested time that everybody shares together, it makes that thing more valuable to them. It has, you know, some kind of relevance. Yeah. And we all had an experience we shared together.
It doesn't. If that time is repeated and regularly scheduled, I think that's where you start to build families and legacies and even this concept that grandparents matter because they become part of passing on those stories and traditions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that having family rituals, and that's a huge part of our parenting, like our family dinners are the song we sing before Sunday dinner, the type of journaling we do in the morning, the type of journaling we do in the evening as a family, the, you know, the bedtime music, the trips to the tennis courts, the six different card games that we play nearly every night of the week. Like our kids find dependency and trust and safety in that. But furthermore, we're not raising our children. We're raising our grandchildren. Right? Mm-hmm. We're not raising our children. We're raising our grandchildren. And the type of traditions that we instill in our children now, those are the things that go on and become a special, dependable part of family, no matter where. You know, if I get uprooted and I got to move to a new state and get a new job or whatever,
they can count on that.
We can still play our Sunday night tennis. Yep.
There you go. Did you both get that growing up?
I got a lot of that growing up.
She did. I've learned everything about the value of tradition from my wife because my family was you know, Christmas morning. What do you guys want to do for dinner tonight? Should we get some Subway sandwiches or, you know, find a turkey that we forgot to pull out of the freezer to thaw or whatever.
Because of that, were you, was that just normal to you and it wasn't a big deal? Or did you ever go through a phase where you had animosity towards your parents because of maybe how you were raised?
So, pleasantly, agnostic. Like, I didn't even know.
Right. How big you're normal.
Until I met Jessa, and I thought it was super
weird. Yeah, most people
weird.
Think my...
She's like, oh, we got our annual trip to the coast. We do it at this time every single year. I'm like, annual trip? Like, you actually do that the same place every year? Or you know, this is the color of the plates that we use on Christmas. And this is what the name tags look like for Thanksgiving. And this is the exact Easter egg hunt that we do every Easter. And for me,
back against that?
I didn't push back against it, but it was just super weird for me. Like, yeah. I never, and oh my goodness, like, pinch me now. I got so lucky, you know, marrying a girl who actually knew about the importance of traditions, because our kids are they're so stable at home because there's so much they can depend on every day of the week. You know, predictable environments remove a lot of fear and anxiety.
So I want to hear from Justin, because when you have the difference like this, and I know Katrina and I have this, there's always some sort of resistance somewhere. What has been the greatest challenge for you with him because of the way he was raised that you guys have had to work through together?
You know, it wasn't like doing the same thing at Christmas or, you know, Easter or whatever, or having those traditions around certain holidays. It was honestly more of the tradition in the daily routines.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, I grew up in a family. My dad, he was a farmer. He raised cattle. He came home 5 o'clock every night. We had dinner at 6 o'clock. Everybody came together. And then we enjoyed maybe a half hour TV show with popcorn. You know, there was always tradition built into the day. Mm. And so for very, very long.
And she married me where I'm on a plane to Abu Dhabi to race a triathlon. One week back working, you know, 10 to noon, 3 to 5, 8 to 11 p.m. at a gym. And then, you know, coming home, trying to build an online business till 2 a.m. It is just all over the map, because I grew up with a dad who literally would hold the same job for like a year and then go start a new company and then sell that and like buy a franchise and then, you know, go and buy some old ambulances and start to do, you know, ambulancing. Like, my dad was all over the map. So she grew up in a very dependable, traditional,
consistent,
you know, farmer type of environment. Whereas I grew up with, you know, a dad who was just all over the map in terms of entrepreneurship.
Mm-mm. So that was a different, cause I could see how the annual traditions is like, where
that's
Ben,
understandable.
Yeah. Ben can be like, yeah okay, fine. We'll do this.
Right. The day to day had to been
like
hard.
Every day. It's like, this is what we do in the morning. This is what we do at night. This is what we do it. Yeah. I could see how that would be, you know,
it took me a long time. And now, like, I can, like, the day does not feel right unless we have our family dinner with our card game, with me playing ukulele or guitar to the boys afterwards, with our, you know, we do self-examination and purpose at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, we say in our journals, what good have I done today and what could I have done better today? So we learn from both our successes and our failures. And what is one way that I lived out my life's purpose? Because I've taught my children from a very early age to have a strong purpose statement, you know, to have their ikigai, to have their plan de vida, the thing that rips them out of bed in the morning, that gives them a lens through which they see a lot of the boxes that they might be checking during the day. You know, in the end, ultimately, how is this helping you to fulfill your purpose? And then in the morning, same thing. We meet as a family out in the sun on the deck. We've got a 5-minute meditation app that we go through called Abide that walks us through like a little verse from scripture and a prayer. Then we all write down one thing we're grateful for and one person who we can pray for or help that day. And all these little things, they rubbed me the wrong way at first. To me, it felt like being just like an old fuddy-duddy TV show family from the, you know, 50s or whatever, like Leave It to Beaver. And now, like, it is the most magical part of the day, these little traditions.
They ever request any specific songs from you now, like some AC/DC or anything?
Yeah, they know a little bit of the playlist, but they're really into epic movie soundtracks, which I can't play.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but
Wayne Norton too.
I took him into a recording studio for a Christmas gift for mom, and they really like The Greatest Showman, which has a lot of really epic tracks. We recorded a whole album for mom in a recording studio, and then they also really like super heartfelt, like praise and worship songs. So, they're very into like praise and worship. So they usually like that kind of stuff, or sometimes like just like an old school hymn.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? Yeah, check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. That'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com.
By the way, nice. it sounds amazing. And you know, speaking to these rituals or traditions, this is how cultures are created.
Absolutely.
And you know, one thing about humans is when you look at things that last for thousands and thousands of years, that's because we've found significant value in. Otherwise, it wouldn't last, right? This is part of evolution. You know, people who are into science, who understand evolution from a biological sense, you also need to understand evolution from a cultural and practical sense, and behaviors and practices and cultures. We often take them for granted because they've been around for thousands of years, and we tend to look at them and be like, well, that's stupid. Why do we have to do it that way? Everybody's been doing it so long. Maybe we even view it as oppressive or whatever, but the reality is it exists because humans have found it tremendously valuable, and oftentimes in ways that you don't even fully understand because it's been around for so long. But as I'm listening to this, and I think, again, what you guys are doing is extremely valuable, I also know that you have 2 12-year-old boys. They're about to become teenagers.
Yeah.
And like all kids, I'm sure they give some pushback sometimes. I mean, I don't think there's any perfect person out there, let alone perfect kid. What do you do when your kid says, I don't want to do the thing
we do? Or what is it that they give pushback?
Like, how do you handle that?
Well, first of all, and I think maybe it was when we recorded in Tahoe, we talked a little bit about on one of the previous podcasts that we recorded together about this idea of love and logic style parenting, educating your children on the consequences of their decision, then as much as possible, allowing them to make the decision. Am I going to eat gluten? Am I going to, you know, look at pornography? Am I going to, you know, smoke a cigarette? You know, any of these things, you teach your children about the impact on the brain, the impact on the body, the potential societal implications, and then you let them make the decision and deal with the consequences, right? Maybe, you know, poor performance at school the next day because they punished, you know, three cupcakes at their friend's birthday party. I'd rather them learn that way than me say no cupcakes and them feel like
I actually took a whole course. They have a free course right now online, Love and Logic. And the one of the things that they say on there that's so powerful. So they give the example. Here's an easy example. You're going out somewhere. It's cold and you tell your kid, hey, make sure you grab your jacket. I don't want to wear a jacket. Right. So the old school way would be like, get your jacket, put it on. The Love and Logic way would be like, okay, don't worry. And then when you go out and they're freezing and there's, oh my God, it's cold. You empathize with them. Like,
gosh,
oh, I know.
Be a bummer.
Right. Yeah. That really sucks or whatever.
It is cold.
And they learn from that. And the way that they sell it, which I think is brilliant, is if they learn those lessons now, then they don't have to learn them the hard way later on when it's like getting drunk driving or, you know, things that have real serious consequences. So take the course. I really think it's valuable.
It is. And there are two other considerations here with this style of parenting. A, it only works if you're a really good example, right? You can't tell your kids, oh, you can use the phone and the television and the video game platform as much as you'd like. You know, it might hurt your eyes a little bit. You might not sleep that well tonight. But if you say that and then every night after work, you're plopped in front of Netflix for 2 hours, then that's what your kids are going to have as a good. Like in the Greenfield house, if there's downtime, 90% of the time I'm holding a musical instrument or I have a book in my face. Mm. Right. I am not on my phone. I'm not playing a video game. I'm not parked in front of a screen. So when my kids have downtime, like their go-to thought pattern is not where's my iTouch or I'm going to go hunt down some videos on YouTube on a MacBook. Then the other thing, and this is new for me, is that I think that sometimes that style of parenting can lead almost too much to you wanting your kids to like you, you know, or as Jordan Peterson would say, don't do things that would make your kids dislike you or don't do things that would make your kids hate you. Sometimes I think we can take that in too far the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. I don't want my child to ever feel as though they were deprived or as though I told them they had to do something because we use this whole love and logic, don't ever make your kids angry type of approach. You know, for example, you know, I have decided that even though for the longest time I've been writing out little workouts for River and Taryn to do, you know, so you guys got to do 60-pound pet sandbag one time around the obstacle course and you know, you do this three times this week or your workout today is 5 goblet squats, 5 push-ups, you know, dead hang for max time. And you're going to do 5 rounds of that. I was not being a good father. I was not being a good leader. I was not being a good king in terms of basically me almost parenting through checkboxes and giving my kids little assignments that they could or could not do, but great if you've done it versus me literally bringing them out with me and sacrificing, you know, my podcast time or audiobook time or my favorite Spotify artist time to just go inside my own head for a workout and instead take them with me and have them suffer in a way that they kind of sort of don't want to suffer. You can tell along with me because let's face it. I think a 5 a.m. paper route like I had when I was a kid, like if my parents would have told me that, oh, you could or could not do that, it's up to you. But because they said you need a job and we have a paper route job, so go work, make money. I think that's character building. And so I think that you sometimes have to get to a point where you are telling you're putting your foot down. You're saying, yo, this is going to be good for you. Let's go out to the garage. We're going to sweat for a half hour. It's not. Do you want to come with me? Mm-hmm. It's we're going out. We're going.
And also it's just coming alongside your kid and doing something with them rather than telling them because it's not you're sacrificing your time, which is a display of love towards that person. And so really, I think in all of this, love has to be seen in everything that you do for your child because they won't have trust for you if you aren't displaying that to them regularly.
That's
in putting them to bed and not just saying good night, see you in the morning. It's putting them to bed. you know, making sure they have everything they need. Maybe they need that prayer or that song that or that ritual.
Oh my gosh.
It's literally just so like good. taking your time and giving to them.
I 100% agree. Mm-hmm. So what do you do when your kid, like, do you have an example of time when your boys was like, I don't want to do that journaling today. I'm not going to do it. Or, you know, I don't care about that right now or whatever.
I don't feel like I've ever, and this sounds crazy to probably people, we don't receive a lot of pushback from our boys in that way. Yeah. I haven't seen that.
No, we don't. I mean, they're not perfect. Like, you know, because they're unschooling. They each have their own little MacBook, and sometimes they'll have, you know, like they take one course called Mathnasium where they have an online math tutor, and sometimes they've got little homework assignments. And, you know, I was finding with increasing frequency, I'd walk into them and you could tell they were switching browser windows really fast to like show that they were on task. And where my mind goes is I can tell them, hey, you're hiding something from dad and taking your computer away from a week, you're grounded. Right, but what I said to both of them in two separate conversations, because sometimes you want to be careful not to embarrass one kid in front of the other or make one feel like, you know, they're wrong and the other's right. So I took them aside and I said, look, I'm not stupid. I can tell when I walk into the room, when you're on your computer and you're quickly switching browser windows, that you're doing something that you feel might not be the best use of your time or that I might disapprove of. And I told them, look, I don't care. It's your time. It's your life. It's up to you whether or not you want to waste your life or squander your education or spend time on some silly cartoon website versus applying yourself and doing what it is that's going to make you a better person in the moment. But my one request is that you not hide it from me. You don't have to be embarrassed. If you have a certain website you're visiting that you want to visit, go for it. Do it. Just don't feel like you have to hide it from me, because you're not going to get in trouble. All you're doing is you're ruining your own life, and that's up to you. Just please don't hide it from me. Mm-hmm. Right? So those are the type of conversations.
It's like, that fuck, Cartoon Network is ruining my life.
Well, so here's the other thing too that sometimes I worry about. Now my son is about to turn 15. My daughter's 10. So, you know, kind of close in age to your boys. And obviously I'm a fitness and health person, right? And I've seen this before. I've seen this before where, you know, I had a family member whose dad was an herbalist and super into health and whatnot. And the kids had to eat. Everything was healthy. They didn't get all the processed foods that everybody got. And every, you know, when it was their birthday, they didn't get the normal cake. They got the super crunchy, you know, whatever cake with no sugar. And what ended up happening to both of them is the second they got out of the house, they went super far.
I'm cracking up right now, just thinking about like sells kids have like this, a rye cracker for their birthday.
Yeah, they went super far in the opposite direction, and so sometimes I get or I've also seen where parents are super into fitness to where the kid maybe feels like it's a bit tyrannical, and so they have this bad relationship with fitness. And then when they get out of the house and they're on their own, I never want to work out type of deal. What do you do to ensure that either that doesn't happen, or if it does happen, that they end up coming back to, you know, the right thing?
Well, I don't know. Here's my feelings on that is my own personal journey myself is my parents didn't force fitness or food or anything on me, really. And I was allowed to come to that at my own time. Now, I think my parents instilled in me like an understanding of this is good for you, this is not good for you, you should maybe be active and not sedentary. You know, they instilled those virtues in me, but they didn't force them upon me. And so I call it, we're not raising dogs, we're raising spiritual beings. Mm. You know, you're not raising your kids to do this and obey and this and that. You're raising them to have a spirit and be able to make a decision and have virtue. And so to me, I really feel that if you are teaching your kid anything, if it's not done in the heart of love and they don't understand that you love them and that's why you're teaching this to them, is because you care about them, then it's going to kind of hit tin and just bounce off.
Mm-hmm. I think the independence that comes with adolescence, which we're of course increasingly going to experience as our kids, you know, grow into teenagerhood, dictates that a child will want to do the opposite of what their parent is doing to assert their own independence. Sure. That's just the way that things are. And so I fully expect, and I'm fully prepared for River and Taryn to be the anti-gym rat, or the person who prides himself upon maybe having a little bit of pooch and being a member of the chess club and playing a lot of piano, just because dad is so into fitness. And I want to that's not cool. Right. Yeah. Not that I'm saying that adolescence, I think sometimes it's used as a crutch for or an excuse to go into full rebellion. But I think some amount of asserting one's independence and sometimes asserting one's independence by trying to do the opposite of what their parent may have done is understandable. But for me personally, like I think that you always kind of experience that prodigal son-esque moment where you come back and you realize the value. Like my dad used to give me books that I absolutely did not want to read. I mean, like Christian apologetics and, you know, sermons by C.S. Lewis, just all this stuff. I was just like, why do I want to read this? Just like, you know, the way I think about it as a teenager, Jesus freak drivel and, you know, just this random religious philosophy. Like I want to be reading about, you know, I loved fantasy fiction and I loved space fiction. That's the kind of stuff I wanted to read. But now coming full circle, like when I've got downtime and I feel like I really want to feed my spirit and feed my soul and challenge myself intellectually, I mean, that's what I'm reading. I'm reading, you know, John Piper and C.S. Lewis and Doug Wilson and all these deep, logical, philosophical books on religious, on religion or on apologetics. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, geez, I'm doing exactly what my dad did.
Like,
it took me 30 years to see the value in that. But, you know, all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm growing my spiritual muscles now. I understand what dad was about. Yeah, but I came to that place. So I think you show your kids what's important. And then at a certain point you just, yeah, you trust God that they're going to, if you've exposed them to the right type of things, eventually make the right decisions, even though they'll probably go in through that independence.
Gotta be the hardest thing to do as a parent. That's gotta be the hardest thing because you know what they're gonna do. You see the pitfalls and you just gotta let them do it. That is really, really hard.
Yeah, but you know what's really cool is I've seen my parents go through that and see their daughter take really hard nosedives and do really stupid crap.
How did you rebel?
Jessa Rebel?
Yeah. I like to teeter on the edge, but I never fully plunged.
She rebelled by marrying me.
Yeah, I basically did.
Did any of you guys have siblings that rebelled or went the complete opposite? Like, did you guys?
Yeah, I think I would imagine everybody's got a little bit of a black sheep.
There's a black sheep in every family. Absolutely. Yeah. But what I was saying is I'm like, I got to witness my parents walk through that and go through the fire of that. I lived through that with them. And so to see how they reacted to that and how they walked through that, it was just honestly with a lot of faith and a lot of prayer. And that's all you can do at that point because they are their own person. And at some point you do have to let them. You got to let him go and just, you know.
Yeah.
You got to let him go.
Rest in promises, basically.
Here's what I think. And here's why I think that idea, like whatever they say, 99% of the time you're going to spend with your child is done with by the time they're 18. So you better just make every minute count and, you know, live every moment with your kid as if you're going to be in your deathbed that night. And you know, everything has to be epic. And, you know, I think that's based on a flawed theory. If you have built up traditions, if you have built up rituals, if you have built up an environment where parents are honored and grandparents are honored and children are honored, then you create a scenario where, you know, when your kids are 18, they want to keep coming back for more. When they've flown the nest and they've started their own family, they still want to keep coming back to their original family or including their parents and their extended family and their rituals and routines and traditions because the entire family is built upon these deep-rooted traditions. And so, you know, I think that even though a lot of kids are going to have times when they go their own way, our job as parents is to create this safe nest full of traditions and habits and rituals and routines and dependency and trust that just makes them want to keep coming back for more as they age and then take you when you're old as a parent into their home. Because I think that's another big issue with parenting, with the value of parents and with the honor of being a father and a mother right now in culture is A, we hide away old people. Right? We hide away old people because we don't want to care for them. We don't want to give them the time. We don't want to give the attention. And then, and I mean, this is probably, this probably delves into the politics that I know you guys love to talk about so much. We kill a whole bunch of little people every year, 40 million of them. Right. And so when we say, okay, we care about babies, but you know, there's several tens of millions that we're willing to kill for convenience's sake each year. And then we care about parents, but when they get old and it's inconvenient, you got to like change their diaper and they stink a little bit, we're going to hide them away. Right. So I think on both ends of the spectrum, there are some issues that cause us to a certain extent to devalue parents and devalue children.
Well, there's one I'll move away from the third rail there a little bit, but I'll move to one that's a little bit much less of a third rail, but sometimes is also, I think, is a big one is that I think fatherhood has been totally devalued in modern societies.
We just had this conversation.
We did.
You watch TV shows and how they display the father.
Modern Family, right?
Yeah, he's an idiot. Yeah. He's a bumbling whatever. He doesn't really do much. He has no value.
He's like the jester. He's a clown. And
yep.
And so here's what I think the problem is. And we run into a lot of this, like in the health space, anti-aging, mm-hmm. longevity, Peter Pan syndrome, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm going to be a boy and have fun and go to, you know,
never
like,
tie myself
like for
down.
Me, I'm right. going to go to Spartan races and triathlons and get the, you know, stem cell injections in my dick and do all this like cowboy Peter Pan. I'm going to be a boy forever type of shit. When in fact, living like that, having all the biohacking toys, having the workouts, you know, being the buddy because you really want your kids to like you and the clown and the jester. Not that there can't be some light, playful aspect to being a father, mm-hmm. but I think too many dads are not freaking like kings, true leaders, fathers, mm-hmm. strong rocks that the family can depend upon. And, you know, another part of that too is just, you know, welfare parenting, right? So many single parent households with mothers. Government steps in and takes the role of the father. So dads, a lot of times, they don't even need to be a dad, right? Because somebody else is going to care for
well,
the family.
A lot of
boys running around.
Yeah. In a lot of the old, you know, cultures, I talked earlier about how things exist for thousands of years, oftentimes because we find lots of value. When you go to a lot of these old cultures, it's almost like a way to brag when you're a father with a lot of kids. Like when men talk to each other, say, how many kids do you have? I have 3 kids. Well, I have 4. Like, wow, you know, that's awesome, whatever. It's the opposite in our culture. If you are, you know, you tell a buddy of yours that you have 3 kids and they'll respond with like, oh God, that sucks. Yeah. Well, I'm going to, you know, I got my Corvette and, you know, I get to bang hot chicks all the time. And that sucks that you have to, you know, do that kind of stuff. And they laugh about it or whatever. It's crazy that we don't prize that anymore. And by the way, you can disagree all you want. The statistics are clear. They're crystal clear. Children raised without fathers are many, many times more likely to end up in all the terrible situations. Everything from prison to drug abuse to suicide. We are in it's like a pandemic of fatherless societies. It's really sad.
And this comes because you were asking about my childhood. My father was somewhat absent, meaning he was not a very high quality time. You know, lots of hugs type of dad. He was off running businesses, starting businesses. He's naturally quiet, naturally introspective, naturally good at being an introvert and, you know, kind of off doing his own thing. Like I tend to be pulled towards. His father was the same way, right? Always locked away in the office, always working or using work as an escape. So coming down to me and this idea of you're not raising your children, you're raising your grandchildren. I have come to the realization a very strong way over the past year or so that if I don't break that cycle, if I continue to, you know, parent through checkboxes, whatever, you know, River and Terry, here's your workout. Is that dad's headed out to LA for 8 days. I'll be back and check in on you guys and make sure everything's, you know, going well. And if I am not a fully present father, if I am not a leader, if I'm not the king of my household, then it's going to show my children the example of the father that a Greenfield father is. And then they go forth and do probably something very similar to what I did. Marry a really strong woman, you know, because Jess is an amazingly strong woman. She's super, you know, independent, self-sufficient, even a little bit of that avoidance syndrome versus the attachment syndrome that I have. So she can operate on her own just fine. And it's very easy for me to let her wear the pants in the family, to let her be the leader. And so I can be a little boy, you know, off, you know, pulling on a Speedo to go swim in Hawaii in a triathlon while she's at home holding down the fort. And, you know, the question I've increasingly been asking myself is that what a Greenfield father should be known for? Should a Greenfield father be known for being the playful little boy off having great adventures, married to a really strong woman, so the kids are taken care of at home? Or should a Greenfield father be a leader, be a king, be someone who really takes their children under their wings and trains them and spends quality time with them and sometimes has them suffer along with him and really, really teaches them how to be a man? And I would say that I think the latter is far more valuable than your kids liking you because you're just like the clown around the house.
That's a very powerful realization. Mm-hmm. Now, have you found moments recently where you were about to take off and go do something and then you stopped yourself and you go, canceled your flight or canceled your trip and said, I'm staying home? I mean, have you had moments like that in this last year where, because you're right, when you have something so deep that it's generations, your father, your grandfather. That shit's so deeply rooted that that's always going to be default for you.
It's hard to be aware of.
And I have the same similar type of thing, is to go bury myself into work. And so I have to always kind of check back in, like, is this me kind of running away without even realizing I'm running away? And, you know, can I pass on this?
I didn't have to cancel anything because God bless COVID that did it all for me. But what I have done, one big change I have made is, and this has been really remarkable in the way it's just transformed my whole week, my approach to work, my approach to productivity, my approach to procrastination, my approach to prioritization, is Sundays are full on family day.
No calls, no work,
we missed a call on Monday. Let's just shove this one into Sunday. You got time this weekend. I'll ping you this week. And I would find myself sometimes on Sunday, you know, 3 or 4 phone calls, playing some catch up work, you know, just getting things done.
Sure.
Now, knowing that Sunday is coming and that's a full on family day, it really gives me hyper focus every other day of the week. And then when Sundays roll around, not that I'm not spending quality time with my kids every day, but that's been transformative to have that one day where it is nothing but family and faith focused.
I love that. Now, you've mentioned spirituality and faith a few times, and I've been on my own, and I've been public about my own recent spiritual journey. I used to be very atheist, and then I became agnostic, and more recently now I've been pulled to the Christian religion quite a bit, and I've learned quite a bit of it. And there was a moment that Justin, Adam, myself, and Doug were invited to listen to Bishop Barron and Arthur Brooks speak. And it was one of the most, Arthur Brooks is a very, I don't know if you know who Arthur Brooks is.
Yeah, powerful speaker. Yeah.
Very, very powerful, effective. Actually, one of the most genuine, nice people I've ever met in my entire life. He's one of those people you meet every once in a while that you immediately feel their energy and you want to give him a hug. Just a great guy. And he said something so powerful that literally Justin, Adam, and myself, and Doug looked at each other and looked away quickly because all of us were
kind
on the
emotional.
We were all on the verge of tears.
Yeah. I love that.
He said something very powerful, and he said about the power of going to church with your children as a father. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, "Here you are, if you're a good father." I'm paraphrasing. He says it much better, but here you are, a good father. Your children see you as the most powerful person in the world. If you do a good job and you're a good parent, your children will look at you as the ultimate role model. And it's totally not unusual for a kid, especially a young kid, to think that their dad,
you're the strongest person ever,
is the strongest, most powerful, most whatever. Which is not a bad thing. You're the protector of the family. They think, and I remember thinking that about my dad. And he says, to go to church to see the most powerful man in your life bend a knee and praise and give to someone else, basically saying, I am this one thing's servant or this God's servant. He said, what a powerful message. All of us sat there like,
yeah,
what really? a powerful thing to show your child, you know,
the perfect example of a father and a son is God and Jesus, and a perfect example of something that fathers can aspire to is to be as great a father as God. And so when you are a good father or you're a powerful father, you're a leader in your home, you're absolutely right. And you show your kids that you still get down on bended knee, that there's still something that you fear, there's still something you honor, there's still something you have a great deal of reverence around. And it is this, you know, this creator, this greater power, this absolute truth. I think that also shows kids that there's even a greater rock, there's even a greater foundation. And honestly, I just think the whole idea that there is an absolute truth, that there is absolute morality, you know, in my opinion, that's part of the strong fabric that knits cultures together. And that keeps morality from unraveling.
It's not shakeable.
You have to have that. The very idea of this country when it started, you know, there was a period of time when anybody could come here. It didn't matter who you were, where you came from. You could come. You were welcome. And you think to yourself, how did that work? You got all these different people. And I've heard people say, oh, they're all Europeans. They're all the same. The stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life because they've been at 2 world wars with each other. They were very different. Germans, Italians, Irish, you know, they were all very, very, very different. They all came here. How did they all get along? They all had a underlying appreciation, respect, and belief in liberty, in freedom. So this is how they all got along. So that when you say this absolute morality, the only way different people can ever work together and still be very different is if they have one, they have this common thread of something. And that's what this absolute morality, this is why when morality is subjective and not objective, you run into a lot of different problems. But the question I want to ask you, Ben, you're very spiritual. You've mentioned, Jesus and God. So obviously a very strong Christian, but you're also a very analytical, objective, scientific minded individual. Mm-hmm. So aside from the specifics that you find in Christianity, and in your religion, from an objective, scientific, standpoint, what are the values of having a spiritual practice or a belief system? Are there values? Because these days it seems like that there's constantly people are saying there's no value in that. It's silly. It's it's make believe. Why do we even do it? Obviously, it's existed in every
morals
culture.
Are relative.
Yeah, every culture forever has had some kind of a strong belief system. So there's obviously value, but from that standpoint, what are the why is that important to have?
Right. Well, there's two things to consider here. The first is when you're talking about science and reducing everything to scientism, if you want to call it, everything must be proven. There must be a reason for everything. If you trace everything back to its ultimate origin, everything must be explainable. And it's very difficult to be a respected authority in a field of something like fitness or nutrition, you know, as kind of like shallow science as those fields might be considered to be, and to make statements that you want to be respected for when at the same time you have admitted that there comes a certain point where when you've traced something back from tissue to cell to atom, to molecule, to quark, to proton, to electron, and stripped everything down to its tiniest component, the tiniest little thread of existence, you will get to a point where you can either say, well, we're going to keep on digging because we're going to figure out what came before this and what came before this and what came before this. We can eventually explain away everything via science. Or you get to a certain point where you throw up your hands and you say, I don't know. It's magic. Something made, like some higher power that I don't understand made this. And I'm just going to have the faith that that happened and resist even the mild arrogance that I might be able to explain away everything in the universe. And that's tricky to be involved in a field that depends upon science. And at the same time, essentially say the equivalent of, yeah, I believe in unicorns and berries and fairy tales and magic, but I'd rather live in a world of magic where there's deep hope that there's a story written for your life, that there's a big guy upstairs watching out for a buddy, that this entire universe around us and all the wonder of it from smoked clams and cannabis to sourdough bread and a good red wine to, psilocybin and dumbbells and everything. Like, these are all wonderful, wonderful works of creation that we can simply enjoy and not necessarily feel that there's an extreme need to have to explain away via science. And well, so that's one part of really the difficulty is getting to the point where you just say, yeah, I believe in faith. I believe in magic. So, judge me for it. And then the other part of it, when it comes to the value of this, we know that there's a lot of data out there about how people who are churchgoers tend to have reduced all-cause risk of mortality. Maybe that's the community. Maybe it's the tiny thimbleful glass of hermetic-inducing red wine every Sunday. Like, who knows? But we know that for a fact. We know that gratitude lowers blood pressure, improves sleep, increases empathy, increases self-control. We know that this self-examination practice increases the amount of actual productivity and impact that you make with your life. We know that having a purpose statement actually is associated with higher profile of mood state scores and greater happiness. When you go down the list of all these spiritual disciplines and you read wonderful books by guys like Richard Foster and David Wallace on all the spiritual disciplines, gratitude, service, community, worship, solitude, purpose in life, silence,
abstinence. That's a big
absence, everything. You wind up with this list of things that ultimately have deep physical and physiological and psychological,
which these people came
benefits.
From faith.
Right.
It's not because they had a scientific book
telling them. And all of them are even fasting, right? Mm-hmm. Fasting did not originate from science. It originated from religion and
it was a spiritual, it was for spiritual God. Health, not yeah. for physical health.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what it was for.
Exactly.
You know, it's fun. So for me, what kind of got me, you know, to move in this direction was a few different things, but well, one of them were some of the ideas that seem to work so well are not obvious. For example, the idea that, and this comes from, religion, the idea that all people have, are born with inalienable rights, which is, you know, it's in our founding. What a weird, radical, crazy idea. Totally not obvious. For most of human history, there were kings and queens and peasants mm-hmm. and slaves and nobody, who would come up with such an insane thing? Mm-hmm. From a reasonable, logical standpoint, you can look around at people and observe, and obviously that's not true. We're all so different. We're all, some people are born this way. So where did that come from? And it came from religion. So that was one of the things that helped me move in that direction. I mean,
that is the gospel, right? Like
right.
God sent his son to die so that the burden and all the shame and all the sin and all the shit that we are born with and that we create and that we live with every single day could be taken upon the back of the extreme suffering and pain. Literally a God from the sky came down to take on. And it says very clearly in the Bible, which I consider to be a source of absolute truth, that was not just done for like the Jews, not just done for the Gentiles, not just done for the Asians, not just done for the South Americans, every single person, right? The grocer, the slave,
woman,
the free
man.
Person, you name it. Everybody is on equal ground when it comes to all of us.
And it's entirely not obvious and reasonable to think that anybody would come up with that, especially anybody with any kind of power. Why would you give away?
Right.
So it's very interesting to me.
The ultimate act of humility.
Yeah. Now, I understand that it doesn't prove that there's a supernatural God. I get that. But boy, the pragmatic, you know, how pragmatic it is, how effective it is at helping create, you know, societies that we value. Boy, is that crazy. The other part is this, is that, you know, let's talk about science for a second.
Quantum physics is magic.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But listen, it kind of is. The observer effects, it's unexplainable. It's kind of magical.
There. But let's talk about science for a second. Science is, I can easily make the argument that it's one of the most valuable, powerful, the scientific method has got to be one of the most powerful tools that we've ever come up with. But here's the problem with science. You mentioned scientism. It has no morality. It's not supposed to. Science doesn't work, if you apply a morality to it. It's supposed to be purely objective. But if you don't have people who have an idea of morality within themselves, here's what science turns into. It turns into not should I, but can I? Is this possible? Like, okay, let's hybrid humans with gorillas to see how strong they can get. Yeah. Let's have children out of the womb because that's convenient.
Monkey embryos.
Yeah. Oh, you know, eugenics. Eugenics is an idea. It's such a terrible idea, right? That we need to get rid of the
horrific
genetically
idea.
Bad people to have a perfect race. From a scientific standpoint and objective, for the collective, it makes perfect sense.
Once science becomes absolute truth, you are on a very slippery slope towards an absence of morality because there is no consideration of whether something is right or wrong, just whether something is true or false. And what's really interesting is a book that I recently read. It was when we were in it was when the boys and I were in Dubai, I think. I was reading this book on the plane, and I sent you this book, Jess, and I'm forgetting. It's about how every single culture has this one great God in the sky who actually is this source of truth and is this source of right and wrong. Many, many cultures have no idea who Jesus was, the gospel, sacrifice, sin, any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But they know like there's this one God who has created like a deep truth and morality that goes beyond, and it's going to drive me nuts that I can't remember.
God.
I can't remember what the name of the book is, but essentially what it comes down to is there is head knowing and there is heart knowing. Head knowing is science, right? Like I know whether something is true or false. I can use reasoning. I can use logic. I can explain away the observer effect by maybe talking about how like particles would interact with the photon. And there's got to be a way to explain this. And then heart knowing is basically just, I just know because I know.
Mm.
I know that I should not walk up on the street to the person holding a wonderful aromatic loaf of sourdough bread, hold a gun to their head, pull the trigger, and walk away with their bread because I wanted it and that felt right to me. right? Like everybody knows in their heart, like that's the heart knowing, you know, even you may not be able to explain, but you know, deep down inside, because you could try to explain it. Well, you could say, oh, you did it because that makes you happy. And that's, and, you know, morality comes from what makes you happy, but did it make the other person happy?
Here's an interesting thought experiment along those lines. It's like you ask somebody, if you could go back in time and kill Hitler when he was a baby, would you do it? And some people might say, well, yeah, I would save lots of people. If you really think about it, he's not Hitler yet. Right. He's a baby. He hasn't done anything yet. So your heart knows that would actually be wrong, even though theoretically I could prevent all this other, you know, stuff from happening. It's wisdom.
It's also a very unrealistic scenario. Yeah, like, never actually run into
something. But okay. So fitness is my expertise. So I like to take things to fitness because that's where I understand the most, I would say. And there's a lot of wisdom in fitness, and I'll explain. Oftentimes, so we do episodes called quas, right? Where people ask us questions and we answer those questions. And there's a question that pops up all the time, which is, if scientists invented a pill that made you fit, lean, and healthy, regardless of what you ate and what you did, would that be a good thing? Now, for somebody who's been, you know, who's took this seriously, understood this, studied this, worked with people for well over two decades, I have developed a level of wisdom with fitness that is beyond the, you know, you get fit, you build muscle, you burn body fat. And so when I hear that, I understand that, yeah, you'll get people who are lean, you know, more muscle, mobile, and that kind of stuff, but they're not going to get the true value.
Yeah,
that you
get. The value is the empty now.
The value is in the discipline and the abstinence and the journey.
It's the journey, not the destination.
It's always the journey. And so that's something that's totally different from the reason and the logic, because the science would say the pill would solve everybody's problem. But here's another example. You have people who seem to have everything that you think that you would want from a logical standpoint: money, power, sex, drugs, fame, and their suicide rate is through the roof. What does that tell you?
I would take that pill daily if it was on top of a mountain and I had to climb up the mountain every morning to get the pill. I'll take it.
Exactly. So I want to take a left turn here, or whatever turn here, and ask you a little bit about homeschooling. I know you guys are big homeschooling.
First, let's talk about Jess's shirt. Did you watch Tiger King?
I did.
He did.
That's a great shirt.
I had to point that out.
I've only seen a couple. Okay.
Yeah. I don't even know what Tiger King is.
Free Joe Exotic.
Yeah, let's get back to it.
I'm glad you don't know. It's a total waste of your time.
It is.
So you mentioned unschooling, which is a form of homeschooling. I had friends who were big in the homeschooling world, and when I started training them, that's how I met them, and I was very skeptical when they would tell me about what they did. They were unschoolers, and I thought, oh boy, I hope their kid doesn't turn out whatever. Anyway, he turned out to be one of the best young men I've ever met. Mm-hmm. I thought he would be lazy and he's just going to play video games all day. Now, this kid is an entrepreneur, started his own podcast. He's become a personal trainer. He's a go-getter, very, very balanced, a well-adjusted young man.
He's no friends. He's depressed. He tries himself to sleep at night.
Yeah, right.
None of that stuff. Now, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of myth around or just incorrect knowledge or information around homeschooling. And along those lines, homeschooling has exploded, not just recently because of COVID, but over the last 10 years, it's exploded a lot. First off, why do you think that is? Why do you think more and more parents, and it's growing exponentially? This is real now. In fact, the public school system is actually quite worried about the fact that more and more people are homeschooling. Why do you think it's exploded so much? And then I do want to get into unschooling and what that means.
Yes, exactly. I posed this question to one of my girlfriends whose kids are in public school. And I, during all of this stuff and recent laws that have been passed in Washington. And I said to her, don't take this as offensive, but I was like, how do you feel dropping your kid off at the state every day and allowing them to pour themselves into your child rather than you pouring yourself into your child? Like, that's a really honest question. And I wasn't trying to be offensive or rude, but, and say that you're doing it wrong. I just really want to pour my values and my values into my child rather than allowing the state to pour their values into our children.
I think that it's good that a parent would want to be with their kids more and want more quality time.
It's not about being with your kids more, it's about
or want to
your value system.
Want to be able to instill more of their family's values into their children. But I think that the human psychology of someone else being able to educate a child and you could drop them off and go to work and fulfill sure. your Maslow's hierarchy while somebody else does the work actually would make homeschooling a less popular notion. And so I think the reason that homeschooling has become more popular is multifactorial, but a big one is technology.
Yeah.
Oh, it makes it easier.
Remote working.
Yes.
Like the ease of being able to find information, find teachers, find tutors, have Absolutely. That be scalable and affordable has made it so that you can homeschool anyone, anywhere in the world. And you can, I mean, compared to even what you could do 20 years ago, have an amazing, amazing education for
Great
a
point.
Child. And then mm-hmm. I think that when you pair that with a little bit of social unrest, you know, increasing school violence, mm-hmm. increasing bullying, increasing amounts of depression and loneliness and suicidal tendencies among children who are simply in an effed up social environment in many cases in, you know, public school or even in some cases in private school type too. Of situation dictates that I think a lot of parents are aware that a school might not be the best place. A traditional school might not be the best place for their kids to be during the day. And as that awareness grows, what I've seen are, you know, I've seen a growth of homeschooling, but I've seen this real shift towards the notion of creative free play, aka unschooling, aka find out what your kids' passions and interests are. Find out what makes them truly excited, what they really want to study, what they're truly interested in. Then surround them with as many arts and crafts and tutors and computer programs and games and activities and museum tickets and everything that they would need to be able to pursue that passion. And then step back and just lightly guide them, you know, make sure they've got somebody to drive them to the place they want to be driven to, and they've got some cooking class, or make sure that they know how to log into the computer for some class they want to take online. So lightly guide them and then just surround them. And then the other important part of unschooling, and this is very similar to that love and logic approach, right? Like use love and logic, but also discipline. So unschool, but also realize there are certain skills that your child is going to highly benefit from having experienced in life that they might not know about yet when they're 6 or 8 or 10 years old. You know, Naval Ravikant, great modern day thinker and philosopher, right? You know, I love a lot of the work that he does. He says there's essentially 5 key tools that a child needs to be able to excel in no matter what career that they go into. And those are reading, writing, right? So being able to consume information at an efficient pace, writing, being able to express thought clearly in written form on paper or via keyboard. Arithmetic, being able to just do basic figuring, whether it's geometry or building or woodworking or anything that involves basic math skills. And then finally, logic or computer programming, right, which are technically synonymous, right, like logic slash mm-hmm. computer programming, and then rhetoric slash persuasion. If you can weave in
sales,
reading, yeah. writing, math, logic slash persuasion, or logic slash computer programming and rhetoric slash persuasion, then your child is really going to be set for life. And so we have 12 core subjects that Washington State requires us to show that our child has checked the box for. You know, like they did chemistry this week. Well, yeah, sure. They learned how to make a ravioli, right? And that counts as kitchen chemistry. So we'll classify that as chemistry. But then I'm also very careful to ensure that even if because there's some weeks they don't want to take their online mathnasium class. They probably would not be doing logic puzzles right now if dad wasn't paying him $5 every time they successfully completed a really hard logic puzzle in this logic book that I got for them. So there are certain little things I nudge them towards that I know they aren't super interested in, but that are going to serve them well in life. And then everything else is, you know, weekly family meeting. What are you guys passionate about? What do you want to learn? One local assistant who helps to drive them around and, you know, get them to different activities. One virtual assistant who kind of helps us keep track of all their different passions and interests and, you know, which block of the year are we going to kind of focus on whatever woodworking and which block of the year are we going to focus on building the tree fort and which block are we going to do more wilderness survival and plant foraging. And we just keep a running list of all the things they're interested in and then weave those in throughout the year. And it's scary because there is no model. There is no proven model. There's no one right way to do it
here and there.
And you want, you almost want like a set pattern, habit or routine, because that's what we all grew up with schooling. Mm-hmm. Once you realize it doesn't have to be that way and that kids actually learn really well through this concept of free creative play.
So that's what works really well. So essentially unschooling is no real hard structure.
Yeah, no curriculum. Right?
And, you know, here's the thing. Here's my argument in support of what you're saying. I'm glad you explained it, and you did it so well. Modern society is a lot of specialization. You go to work and you're probably really good at a couple things, and that's how modern society works. You don't need to know everything or lots of little things. You kind of need to be really good at one thing. And for anybody who's, I mean, anybody who has kids, you know, when your kid is into something, like when my boy was 4 years old, you know, he loved Thomas the Train, the train set, the little trains. And there's like, I don't know, 300 figurines or I don't know, maybe thousands, right? And so I saw that he was really into it and he'd build the trains. So I bought him, he had to have at least 100 and something trains. He knew every single name, at 4 years old. There were two trains that were twins. I could not tell the difference. He could. It took me days to figure out how he was doing it. And you know what it was? It was the direction of the eyebrows was slightly off on one or the other. And it's because he was into it. You know, they're like little tiny sponges.
So what are you seeing unfolding with your kids right now? What are you noticing? Do you guys feel like you can kind of predict what they're going to be into or what they're going to do when they get older by now?
Well, they've been saying what they want to do since they were like 3 or 4.
They both love art and writing. Mm-hmm. They love cooking. They have a cooking podcast. And even above like cooking and food prep, they like to create art. Both of their purpose statements are based around inspiring people to joy and adventure with their art and with their writing. River does a little bit more of the writing. Taryn does a little bit more of the art, and they really want to do a lot more publishing of their own books. Oh, they cool. want to live in Moscow, Idaho, 90 minutes from our house where all their nieces and nephews reside. And they want to live down there and make books and kind of have like a little coffee shop that they run during the day and then write books, you know, in the evening or in their off time. And that's what they want to do right now is, you know, be authors and own a coffee shop, which you know, that might change a year from now. They might want to be professional tennis players. You know, you never know, but you sit back and you just let them pursue their passions and resist the urge to push them towards the stuff that you really thought that they were going to be good at, because living vicariously through your children is so easy to do.
It's cruel.
How are you guys teaching them finances right now?
They've got these books called the Tuttle Twin books that are a little bit more of kind of a libertarian conservative approach to the economy and the finances. They go through each month with they're once a week right now with their podcast producer and manager, the financials, you know, what they're bringing in from each affiliate, what percentage the affiliates are.
Oh, great.
They go grocery shopping with mom and with our assistant to help, you know, manage things like, you know, finding deals and finding discounts. Same thing on Amazon. They leave the tip when we go to restaurants. Whenever we're playing card games, you know, they're in charge of keeping track of the numbers and the digits and
it's great because it's all real life. I mean, this is all stuff that you're gonna have to deal with.
Yeah.
So do you guys allow them to buy whatever they want freely, or how does that work for them, saving and spending?
Right. So anytime
they're actually pretty big savers.
Yeah, they're big into saving, but again, we are too. Like, we're just not like, we drive a Toyota Highlander and you know, Dodge pickup, and we don't live very fancy,
flashy life,
you know, flashy lifestyle. I, you know, this shirt cost me $10 from the thrift store, and Jessa makes our furniture, and like we live pretty simple. And so I think they've never really grown up being spendthrifts. Mm. We don't live with the spirit of scarcity, but we also we don't spend a lot of money on random items. But the understanding in our house is that if it's related to education, especially if it's a book, no questions asked, I will buy it for them. I will provide them anything that really fuels something that they want to learn about, something they're passionate about. If it's a Nerf gun, if it's a Lego toy, whatever, then what they do is they send to my assistant Marge, who does a lot of our shopping, what they would like. And they, you know, they have their little email addresses. She finds the best deal and she comes back and tells us how much it is. Then they decide if they want to get it. If they do, she then transfers from their bank accounts where all their affiliate income from their podcast goes, where, you know, any money that they make, you know, gifts that they get for their birthday or Christmas or whatever. And she'll do a transfer until they know that when they bought that, it gets transferred. You know, it's purchased using our Amazon account, but then the transfer occurs from their account into ours. So they're covering.
And they have the freedom to, I mean, if they decide to go on a crazy addiction of Nerf guns and buy them every day, technically could with their own money.
They could. They could do whatever they want with their own money. But again, like, because they see mom, I mean, they see me spending, and this is almost too much. You know, they'll see me spending 10 minutes deliberating over, you know, which AA batteries to get on Amazon, because one pack's like $2 cheaper, right? So we're pretty aware of spending in our home. So I think they're pretty used to just the value of saving / investing. I haven't taken them through any investing courses or anything like that yet, but
Mm, you know, that's awesome. One thing that I've heard from people, and this one's actually quite a disturbing comment I'll get on homeschooling, is they'll say things like, well, there's a lot of parents out there that are really bad. The kids shouldn't be, you know, the parents, a lot of parents shouldn't school their kids and they should go. And to me, this is always such a disturbing thing to hear, because of course there's bad parents out there. But if you added it all up and you did the math and the study, I would trust a parent raising their kid over the state raising your kid, mainly because parents usually care about their kids
or a co-op or a collective. I mean, sure. A homeschooling group. Like there are ways that a parent can be involved in their children's education. And if they don't have the heart of a teacher, or they're frankly a shitty teacher, like there are ways that you can homeschool or unschool and not be. Jess is a wonderful teacher for arts or crafts or gardening, but she's not going to teach the kids calculus or science, because she didn't learn that stuff in college. She doesn't have a passion for it. So that's a big part, is whatever your kids are interested in, you find the person that's going to do the best job teaching them that. It might not be you, and that's okay.
So a little speculation. What do you think is going to happen with the current education model now that formal education, the cost of it is – it's been exploding for years, far faster than inflation. Schools are now either shutting down, kids can't go there, so kids are at home, or – you have to go to school and you have to wear a mask and do this whole thing, which can be very anxiety inducing, I'm sure, in children. They don't know what's going on. Or you have schools that are saying, hey, like Harvard, for example, said, next year, all online. Oh, by the way, it's still $50,000 a year tuition. Yeah. We're not changing the cost. Speculating moving forward, do you think that we're witnessing the beginning of the end of the way that school has been administered because of all these stresses now? And then, of course, technology making it so inexpensive to transmit and receive information. What do you see moving forward with that?
I personally think 100 years from now, we're going to look back and laugh at about the past 60 years or so of education that we've tried to hang on to the threads of, that is all based off the agricultural revolution and the design of factory workers. And it's laughable. I really don't anticipate that model sticking around much longer. And who knows? We might be in the time right now during the COVID pandemic where it's a full on light bulb moment and people really do realize, oh shit, I was paying $50,000 to go to Harvard and they've just admitted that everything that I'm getting from there, I could literally be doing from a beach in Thailand while simultaneously running a surfing
company.
Or for
significantly less.
Yeah. Crazy. Well, you guys are – you're always a great guest, Ben, and I loved having you on, Jessa.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is great. You guys are both very, very good people. I love hearing about how you guys are at home and how everything's going on, and I wish you guys continued blessings and success with everything.
Thank you.
Thanks for letting us emerge from our little hole in the state about you see people.
Well, you're always welcome.
All that from under our rock.
That's right. You're always welcome on our podcast. Dude, so.
It's like a direct flight.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah.
We just got to get you guys up to Spokane sometime.
We're due. We're due.
Yeah,
we're
due. You are due.
We haven't been there in a while. So, all right, guys. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.